folks, it's Danny Tisdale, and I want to thank you and welcome you to the Harlem World Magazine podcast with me, Danny Tisdale, publisher and founder of Harlem World Magazine, and we love it because we get to speak to Harlem leaders, legends, and trailblazers, of course, in Harlem. Again, thank you for being here, and we're going to get right into it, and we're going to talk about Harlem Hot 3 topics on HarlemWorldMagazine.com. We call them Harlem Hot. First is NYC will create the Office of Sports, Wellness, and Recreation from Harlem to Hollis. That should be nice. And we know our readers love it because it's number one on our Harlem Hot. Number two, the Crossroad to Harlem, the historic Apthorpe Farm on the Upper West Side of Harlem, circa 1728, on our Harlem history page. We'll talk a little bit about that more, but that's a super great post. If we say so ourselves, as we talk about what we post. Number three on our Harlem Hot list is Harlem's Mamie Hatcher Johnson. Great audio piece. She was married to Bumpy Johnson, gangster of Harlem. Great, great, great piece. Obviously, and our readers love it too. And number four, this is our bonus piece, Harlem Representative SBI host virtual press conference with the Exonerated Five and Corey Wise and all the rest of the brothers. But without a doubt, that's our top three plus our bonus four. Don't forget to hit us up on our history page at facebook.com/Harlem History, and it's all there for you. Hello, folks. How you doing? It's Danny Tisdale, and you are listening to the Harlem World Magazine podcast as we speak to Harlem leaders, legends, and trailblazers. And we have a great, great, great guest today, and it's Jerry Migdal, who was born in the Bronx. He's a graduate of Stuyvesant High School and Cardozo Law School. He's built a successful business in Upper Manhattan together with his wife of 44 years, get that right, Tisdale, has given back to the community where he's lived and raised his family. He is founder and president, along with his family, of the Migdal Organization, a Harlem-based real estate management and development firm that provides social and legal services and has led several nonprofits dedicated to health, education, and welfare for the Harlem community. And let me tell you, folks, that's only a short piece of his incredible history. And we're just so happy to have Mr. Migdal here with us. How are you doing, Jerry?
I am really doing wonderfully. Thank you so much, Danny. It's an honor and a privilege to be here and to be on your podcast show, not knowing much about it, but I had just briefly looked at some of the guests you had, and you know, I'm honored to be included in the Harlem Legends and Trailblazers just category, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for being on the show, and I want to get right into it because I love, the kind of work that you do when, you step up and no one has asked you to step up, no one has twisted your arm to step up and do the work that you do on the philanthropic side. So, Jerry, I was curious, who in your life has inspired you to do this kind of work?
I've thought about that question a bit since you preempted me with the category, with the list of questions. But just nobody. I was born to a very hardworking immigrant family. One escaped Poland, one escaped Russia, and in the time in the 20s when their Jewish ethnicity was something that was being discriminated against. So getting here, they were hardworking people. My father didn't go to college. He just helped educate himself and skill sets. and hard work. My mother was a teacher, maybe eventually went to college, Queens College, and I got the idea that, you know, you had to kind of work early in life to get anything accomplished for yourself. And at times I felt neglected, but I realized it only helped me build character and strength to persevere and to keep going. You know, the road to success, oh my God, it's a long, winding one. It's full of potholes. It doubles back. You make wrong turns. You find dead ends. You know, and it takes a lot of grit, determination, and ambition in some way. And I think that was instilled in me. It wasn't that I knew too much about racial justice and equality, because I grew up in a very predominantly white Jewish area with a lot of kids, and there was a lot of camaraderie. But eventually, when I went to college after Stuyvesant in the '60s, I became a card-carrying hippie, as they say. So
I remember those. Yeah.
I was a genuine one in 67, 68, went out to Tate Ashbury, went through a lot of trials and tribulations. My wife had a different road. Eventually we would meet after I had really explored a lot and been around. I met her, I just turned 27, and she turned 26, and we were at that point. I knew that I kind of wanted to settle down and find a family and do some things. But I was still an ideologue. I was still affected by the ideology of the hippie movement. And I then learned about racial injustice, and it affected me a lot. If I was going to have live in a society like New York, in a place where you have such diversity and so many different, you know, peoples and religions and faiths and colors, I knew I had to kind of help do something about it. I didn't know how much I had to do. I mean, the protests that we had in the '60s, that we saw again last year, were a lot of the same arguments.
The Black Lives Matter protests,
right? But there were more whites in it, and I felt, you know, that's the coalition that we need, and we have to convince everybody that it's best for everybody that we get along and that we have some kind of equality and justice throughout so many of the systems. And, you know, I've been in real estate, I've been in finance, I've been in college, I've been in Harlem, so I see that. It's really systemic throughout. I'm a lawyer, so I've seen it in the justice systems, and there are so many parts of my life that really kind of have shown me where things can be different, and not being somebody who came from money and being an ideologue. There was one thing eventually that really made an impact on me. It was a New York Times editorial article saying, the heading was "Make Money, Save the World," and so I realized that, you know, coming from my place, I was just a protester, you know, maybe with a microphone. Not really, I wasn't that kind of protester so much, but understanding that making some money, I used to think money was a curse, and, you know, you shouldn't make money, you shouldn't be driven by that, and you shouldn't, and you shouldn't be so greedy, and you shouldn't, you know, about taxes and other things that, you know, affect the wealthy class. So, you know, I have been fortunate. I've had a lot of, like I say, a lot of potholes, and personally, two big bankruptcies along the way. So, you know, going from not having and having to make, and then making them losing.
It hasn't been just wine and roses.
No, it has not. Nothing is wine and roses.
Bankruptcies, right.
I think it's important to have that. My wife was deathly ill before I met her, so she's got another story that led her, you know, led us to a place where we wanted to raise a family, but we wanted to raise a family and have the right values and be able to teach them that and see if we could make a difference in the world. So what inspired me, it's something internally. And I think, you know, together we've inspired each other with a lot of similar ideals and a lot of gratification for doing what we do.
So let me ask you, Jerry, because you said, you know, make a difference in the world, and you are doing that. And I guess that's what I love about the work that you and your family does, is that you put your money where your mouth is, you know, and there's nothing better than that. And but what if someone wants to, you know, Jerry, fall into those your shoes? What advice do you have for someone who feels the same way? They want to make a difference.
I really wish there were more people that did. I mean, I could find that I can suggest things. There are people who volunteer, so there are people who want to help us and do work. So there are events require a lot of logistics and a lot of people. Generally, I use a lot of people from my organization that really want to do it.
Jerry,
yes.
I'm talking about following your footsteps and creating, of course, you know, we can't duplicate or replicate the MGDL Foundation, but what if they wanted to be another Jerry and create their own kind of foundation? I mean, what do you suggest to someone who wants to be...
I would say, look, and there are people, obviously, that have, and I've run across them over, you know, the last 15, 20 years of being in that not-for-profit community and the philanthropy.
Right.
But generally, people don't want to. And that's the problem. You know, I've tried to be somebody...
Is that because you think the work is too hard, or...
Yeah, I think it's both too hard, and I think people just don't want to give up what they've got.
Work hard to make it.
Right. And then, you know, I made it honestly. I got it. I want to keep it for me and my family. And I know that feeling. I want my family to continue and to continue in this footstep and to really have a decent life. And so, yes, I mean, I'm doing that, but I'm doing both. It's not like... you know, first let me take care of that, and then I'll help out. It's like,
gotcha.
I want to leave the world in a better place than the way I found it. I really do think we're at an inflection point in the terms of events that have happened and what has come to light as a result of COVID-19. I think people understand what white privilege means more now, and I think they understand that, yeah, it's true, they do kill them. You know, that video has made a profound difference. I mean, I hope we end up dealing with whether it's true that this happens, you know, what are you going to do? But it's very indicative. Like, you know, it's like Chris Cuomo said on TV. He said, let some of these things happen to white young people and see how the reaction would be, as opposed to, you know,
it would be very different.
So racism and systemic racism is baked into the system, and so more and more and more I've got to see that as I become close to the Harlem community. I see the racial injustice, and I've taken high school kids to see Just Mercy, the movie, and we've dealt with that. I see it in housing discrimination. I see it in differences in financial, and I understand what frontline workers are, and yet they don't get paid like frontline workers, you know. So there are so many things that are really really baked in that it's hard to, you know, to think about how do you affect change. But I think, you know, change happens, history has proven that change is evolutionary in a lot of ways. It's not revolutionary. It's, you know, we're not going to overturn and things, but I think, you know, we have a chance to eat away and to continue to expose, to improve the lives of people of
that's
color,
right.
People have been discriminated against. So that's something that we feel very good about doing. So
let me ask you, Jerry, because you talked about being a long-haired hippie with a dashiki and bell-bottom jeans on and probably wearing sandals.
no, I didn't.
You didn't wear sandals. And we're talking about change, and I always say that because, you know, humans are a step away from still being animals, that we always learn the hard way. But you've got a history where I when I look back on it, I think change has happened. So are you optimistic about the future?
I'm an optimistic person. I am generous. So, I don't look backwards. I look forward, and I have a lot to look backwards on just turning 71. But also, I see the world. I see the world the way I see it. I don't look through rose-colored glasses. I always accuse my wife, take the glasses off, see the world, then put them back on, and make your decision based on the facts that are what's really
when
happening.
You took them off, right?
Right. And so I'm very clear about that, and I think. I'm still optimistic because I see people getting along. I mean, I see that I have so many good friends in the Harlem community, so many more closer relationships, and I see the Harlem community as being very endearing and very close-knit where people care. When we lost our son in Harlem to an accidental overdose
of prescription
meds and alcohol, and I my wife and I found him, and was on Manhattan Avenue and on 117th Street, and for a while I didn't go down that, but the people that commiserated, the people that felt for us were more the people that we knew in Harlem. I had an apartment in my office, above my office on 134th and Adam Clayton. And the people like, don't worry, I've been there. I lost a 22-year-old. A lot of people had lost children. And there was a lot of, you'll get through this, you'll be okay. And, whereas in my communities, friends, people almost like they're afraid to, they don't know what to say and how to deal with it.
Uncomfortable with it, yeah.
Very uncomfortable with death, the death of a child. It's almost like, I don't want to, it's like a disease almost. I don't want to, like, engage, and maybe I'll catch it. In fact, we've lost more of our friends. Between a group of friends, we've lost more of our children than we have lost ourselves.
That's tough. That's tough.
So I see the world is very, very tough for kids. Because I've lost one, and at 22, and I've seen so many of us, I see the world as much tougher now. Even though I think optimistic, it's tough for people, it's tough for kids, which has really kind of pushed us more in our charitable endeavors into educational. It's helped the kids now. Let them, give them a chance. He had trouble growing up. He had trouble. I had to send him to for special ed. He had a dyslexia. That was always troubling, and it was always, it's hard. It's just harder. So basically, I do feel optimistic. I do feel that people get along. I think we can keep going and improving. I think the pandemic, as hard as it was, and as how hard it was for New Yorkers and people in Harlem, and how many people we've lost here through the first surge, I think we've all learned. I mean, there are people like in COVID. There are people who have lived through COVID. In New York, and then there's everybody else, in a sense. Like, once it hit us, like, we've been very, very cognizant of it. And
doing that pivot, and I wanted to go forward, but at the same time go back a little bit, because you did mention that young lady that you've been married to for 44 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm always, just like, your philanthropic work is about relationships. Working in the community is about relationships. I'm always interested in the personal, and especially someone, sadly, rare like you, who's been married for 44 years. You got to tell me the secret. What is the secret? Is it happy life? What is it? Happy wife, happy life?
No, it's not. The truth is opposites attract. Okay, so in a lot of ways we're very opposite in terms of, like, she always says, "Well, I don't know why did you want to go for one of those broker girls? I mean, that were all over you." I said, "I don't want somebody doing what I do." You know, in a lot of ways, we're very opposite. You know, the sad part about opposites attract is sometimes they don't have a lot in common.
So, a challenge, right?
Yeah, there's definitely challenges. But we were opposite. We're attracted to each other very much, and we pursued different things, and we weren't in competition with each other. As soon as we get to the same thing, we're in competition, and that hurts the relationship. So, you know, we've tried to stay out of that. Sometimes I've asked her to be even more supportive and more involved in our endeavors. You know, she likes coming and doing and participating. She loves helping out and you know, just the money, she never questions it. Whatever it costs, she knows. She says, I know you know. You know, this is what we do. It's like our tithe. You know,
our
church, you know, we're giving back. It's like we feel that it's a civic responsibility and obligation. Mm-hmm. So we've been, you know, fortunate to have that. But she's very spiritual. We met in spirit, from spiritual things, endeavors, and so we were attracted to that. Then I drifted away from that to the more mundane, but, you know, I make money first, save the world. You want to save the world. I had to make some money. I had to learn my skill sets, improve that.
Right.
I had to work up and down that road with all the holes, fall down, go through bankruptcies. It doesn't matter. You know, you got to be determined. You know, I'm fortunate to say that I've come out on the other side, you know, much more comfortable after the 50 years of working really, really hard in it. And so my obligations, like to give and to feel like I'm really doing the right thing, helping to make a difference. They do consume a lot of the things that I do. I spend more time on my charitable stuff than on my work.
No, I could only imagine, and it sounds like you guys are really a great team, and support is, you know, in positive ways is so important to obviously the work that you're doing. But I was curious, Jerry, and this may not be fair because some of the guests always say, "Well, that's not a fair question," but I always like asking unfair questions. What's your favorite place? And it's only one, and why in Harlem? Your favorite place in Harlem, and why? I didn't prepare you for this question.
No, you didn't. It's always where my office is, where I am. Mm-hmm. Like that's my comfort zone. It's really where I start from. You know, where I can get people, where we have our supplies, our resources are located. So our office is on 138th Street now. It used to be on 134th. We've been in Harlem for 20 years. It's like a sanctuary. So
yeah,
I'm very comfortable.
I can imagine.
I'm very comfortable there. And we go, there's a lot of places. I mean, like I started in East Harlem. I started in East Harlem on 117th, right near Patsy's, and moved to Central Harlem years later, and then moved one more time where I am now. I've been here for 11, 12 years in this current location.
Believe it or not, Jerry, you know, it's already flown by, and we're at that point. I had, of course, I think I have about 90,000 more questions for you, but I think I'm probably to ask you two more. And matter of fact, it's one more. And, you know, how can our listeners help you with the work that you're doing, I guess, whether it's donating or volunteer or whatever it may be? Can you let our listeners know that and give us your URL and all that good stuff?
You got it. So we are Friends of Public School Harlem. It's FTSH.NYC. That's our website. We're up to date with all our events, what we've done during the pandemic and so forth, and what we're going to do. And there's a donate button. There's also a contact information, and you'll be able to get in touch with our organization. People do get in touch with us and want to volunteer or contribute smaller. We get smaller, but the small amounts, everything counts. And you know, the important thing is that every dollar that's contributed, and we don't raise that much money, so most of the money comes from our pocketbooks. And but every dollar goes out. So we donate all of our logistics, our personnel, our space, all our overhead is paid for by us, by
that's
my organization. And so,
Jerry, just one. Yes. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that. Okay. So you'll be able to get in touch with us in any way.
Can you give your URL one more time for your website?
Yes, I can. Sure. It's F, like Frank, Peter, FPSH.NYC. And that'll take you right to us. And we welcome anybody's contributions. We welcome people helping and volunteering. It's always a good thing. You'll be very gratified by what you're doing. And then you'll acquire a taste for it and want to do more of it. So,
okay. Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate it. And thank you for being on the show. And we'll be posting some of, if not all of, some of the events that are upcoming. I know there's some coming up. And really enjoy this conversation, our first conversation in the podcast. But, you know, I'll be coming back to you. Thank you again, Jerry, for being on the show.
You're welcome, Danny. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Mr. Jerry McDowell. And as we take a quick little break, remember to help us recruit and train the next generation of Harlem publishers at the Hype banner on our website at the bottom left-hand corner. Click it, support us, find out more about what we're doing at Hype. Hype stands for Harlem Youth Publishing Empowerment, as we're teaching the next generation of Harlem publishers. Also, don't forget to hit us up on our Harlem gear, and that's at our Harlem World Gear site, and that's on Zazzle at Zazzle.com/Harlem World Gear. Hit us up, support us. Some of that money goes to Hype to support what we're doing with our kids in the program, our summer program. And as we always say, don't forget to share us, like us, and link to us, and let us know how we can make our shows better. Thank you for being here. And again, hit us up at HarlemWorldMagazine.com. Love you. Bye-bye.